Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm your host, Phil Huff, and with me today, I'm really excited about our guest. We have Carrie Lee Kanoki, a contestant on this season's History Channel's Alone, Season 9, which just concluded Thursday, August 4th. And we are here to talk about her experience now that it's finally over. Carrie can actually talk about what happened, and welcome to the show, Carrie.
Hi, Phil. Good to see you again. Good to be here. Yeah.
It's great to see you. And for listeners who didn't hear, we did a pre-season interview with Carrie, and now we can talk about the whole experience. And let's just get right into it. You were one of the final two contestants, so you made every episode, and it was a really exciting, almost cliff-hanging finish when we watched it as we're recording this last night. And made it to 75 days. What a remarkable feat. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It was fun to be out there. I enjoyed it.
Your face was beaming the whole time through almost all of the on footage cameras. And, you know, we want to talk about that because I'm sure we saw just a small fraction of the experience. That tell us about what the experience was like, the big picture of things, the things maybe we missed.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I really enjoyed myself out there. And it was what I've been wanting to do for such a long period of time. I definitely had my struggles. It was not easy. You know, my legs felt fatigued the whole time I was out there. But I just loved, loved, loved being in that environment. And I just kept having to try and work and get her done. But I just loved every minute of doing it. It didn't seem like a struggle. But I also know that it was not easy. It was a lot of hard work, for sure.
It had to be an absolutely remarkable experience. And although you are well-trained and have been doing bushcraft and practicing many of the skills that you needed for the show for a long time, this had to be a truly once-in-a-lifetime experience. Tell us how it changed you.
Yes, and it was a very life-changing experience. I didn't know how it would change me, because they say that when you do an experience like this, it changes you in some way. But I went in being really solid of who I was. And so I wasn't sure what to expect. And you really can't expect anything. But what it did is, because I'd been wanting to go out there as a child, do nothing but survive with my knife, it allowed me to be able to set aside my childhood dream. Because I was feeling that I had satisfied that dream. And now I feel like I'm ready to step into elderhood and into a new dream, which is the wilderness school that I'm starting. And so it was a rites of passage for me. And my fishing stick, you might have seen that I chopped it off and it became my walking stick. So that stick, I brought it home and it's like my elder staff. And that's gonna be my walking stick for, you know, however long I have it until it walks away.
It's a remarkable, remarkable memento. And I want to get into some gear questions, but I, for a moment here, at day 75, you decided to call in the helicopter. What was that decision like?
That was a really tough, tough decision. I knew that my body was done about 4 days prior to that. I had walked around my island of trees and I was trying to track a snowshoe hare. And you could see there was a moment where I was pounding my chest and I was saying, don't cry, don't cry. I had realized that I had wandered too far away from my shelter. I was super, super dizzy because my blood pressure was down and I could have fainted at any moment, but I just kept going. And I just had this realization, like, the sun's going down, I'm in the shade, I'm not in a good place, I need to get back to my shelter. And there was just this moment where I could have just collapsed. And I was telling myself to not cry, because that would bring my energy level down. And I needed to stay positive so that I could make those steps to get back into the sunlight and make my way back to my shelter. So it was a bit scary, but that whole day, I was lightheaded and I could have fainted at any moment. So that was definitely a warning to me that I had hit my limit. The next day, a storm came in And I still had some food, so I knew I needed to just eat my food. Don't worry about rationing anymore. You're done. But eat your food, get back on track. And then I had to wait out the storm. So on that next sunny day, I still wanted to finish my Roycroft skis. And just to come to completion to that, and I also wanted to honor the lineage of this bushcrafting great grandfather that designed the Roycroft skis. So I was trying to do that to honor that lineage. But it also, if I waited one more day, which I really wanted to do, just do one more day and then tap out. But then I'm gambling because of the weather. Like they cannot come get you with a helicopter if there's bad weather. So this was, I debated about it for a few hours, and then I knew I was like, I have to make the call. And when I pulled my bow back and saw how weak I was like, whoa, really? And I tried it a couple times, like maybe I just need to try harder, but I wasn't. That was my eye opener of like, I'm done. And do I really need to gamble another day and not be able to come out and get me? And I, to be honest, I was hoping they would come do a medical check. And so then I would be extracted. And I actually texted them and saying, do I have a medical check coming up? And then they were just kind of waffling, like, all right, I got to make I need to make this decision for myself. And I know my body's done. And, does it really matter if I get extracted or do I tap out? I'm done. It doesn't matter. Every day out there, I'm just injuring my own body, and staying another day is just another day of injury. So
On
I
camera, you.
but it was really, really hard. My body was ready to go, but my heart and my mind definitely was not wanting to leave. And so it was bittersweet.
It has to be a struggle. And on camera, they show some of that. Thank you for giving us more of the background because they can't possibly show all of the inner workings of your mind. And safety
No.
has got to be a factor. When you make the call, though, it seems from the show that you don't know when you're calling if you're not maybe already the last person, or if it was second to last, or so on. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you really have no idea. And for myself, I felt like, hey, if I'm doing this good, there's got to be like three or four other people out here. And I just assumed that Benji, Terry, and Jesse were still out there. So I figured I was number four, and I didn't even take my tap out that serious. And they cut a lot of it out because I was laughing when they showed. I'm like, hey, guys. But yeah, you really have no idea. And even when you come in, they don't tell you. So I had to find out by different clues that were coming in, like, wow, I think I'm in second. And it just, I laughed for days. Like, this is absurd because all I did was sing out there and have a good time.
So,
Yeah, that was surprising to me when I found out what place I was really in. And do I have a regret for making that call? No, I don't. I made the right choice.
it sounds like the right choice. And so, what were the clues as you're flying back over? You kind of see the visual landscape and can observe whether there's people down there or not, or what are some of the other things you're picking up on?
Yeah, you can't see where other people are, and you don't really know where other people's boundaries are. I did ask the helicopter to fly over the backside of my site because I knew there was a river there. And when I flew in, I saw that river, and it looked like about 2 miles. Like I tried two or three times to get to that river. Adam found that same river almost on the same day that I was trying to get to it, which was a little synchronistic on that part. But when I flew out, I asked him to go to that river again, and it looked more like 5 or 6 miles. It looked like a long ways, and I would have never made it. It was, especially in the condition I was in, it was just not worth the calories to even go there.
So, on the show, after you were out, the final contestant, Juan Pablo, was 3 more days before they came in for what seems like a medical check. He had an interesting strategy, too. It seemed, and I might have the numbers off a day or two, that he chose to fast for almost the last 26 or 27 days. And I remember during the episode where he made that choice thinking, well, that's an interesting strategy. And given how much weight loss all the contestants had experienced and how harsh the conditions are, I didn't think it was going to be a successful one, but it proved to be. I know you have a few thoughts on that, so would you mind sharing them?
Yeah, it's a really interesting strategy, and I learned a lot about that. Well, we were both in aftercare for another 10 days, so we got to talk a lot about it. And he's written a book called Thrive. It's about a long-term survival. So most survival books are about, how to live long enough to be rescued, where he was really going for the long term. And so his strategy of not eating was to slow down his metabolism of his body. So he didn't need to be consuming as many calories to stay alive. He was also conserving his energy. Everything he could possibly do to shave off a few more calories was working for him. And that worked great for me. That worked great for him. I also was conserving my energy. I was still going out there and trying to find food, but I was no longer walking all the way over to my trap line. I had two trap lines. One was further. I stopped going to that one. And I was doing very minimal. And for example, that one day I had the snowball fight, that's all I did that day. And it was just at that point, I was thinking of tapping. So I was like, I'm just going to enjoy myself. And I had this little snowball fight with myself. And that took me 2.5 hours to film. And then I was exhausted and I went to bed. That's all I did the whole day. But besides that, I was really conserving as much as possible of my own calories as well, but I was also still trying. I was still trying to find food. And so that was different. My strategy versus Juan Pablo's is I had my food rations and I had my berries and my fruit leather. So I was eating something every day. And it wasn't enough to maintain my body weight, but it was something to keep my stomach active, giving it something to do so it wasn't thinking about food. So that's how I dealt with it. I don't know if there's a right or a wrong. My metabolism slowed down a lot as well, but it's a different psychology for the stomach. The different strategies is gearing your stomach to work differently.
That makes sense. You've brought up a whole lot of things that I want to explore some, but while we're on the topic of the final days and fasting and medical checks and care, I'm really curious how the medical checks worked. If they were on a regularly scheduled same day, same time every week, or were they random and did the show's producers alert the contestants, or it sounds like there might be also a way to check back in with them. Tell our listeners a little more about how the medical checks work.
So the medical checks, they were roughly around a week apart. And that changes. You don't know when they're going to happen. You don't know when they're scheduled because it's day by day changes for them as well. For example, on the day that Timogen tapped out, they give you a 24-hour notice that we're medical check tomorrow morning. That's all you know. And then they'll text you 1 hour before they actually come. So I was getting my medical check on day 62, and that morning they texted me and said that they were canceling and mine would be the next day. So what was happening is Timogen was tapping out. And so they never know because everything's due to weather, what's going on, someone might get hurt. There's a lot of demand and they can't predict ahead of time, but they're roughly about a week.
Thank you. And that brings up the whole topic of timekeeping. Out in the wilds alone with very limited supplies, I'm sure you didn't have a watch. How did you keep track of what day it was or how many days had passed?
Yeah, so every morning and every evening, we were supposed to do a morning monologue and an evening monologue or journal. It's like in the morning, good morning, I'm going to do blah, 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 blah. What are you going to do today? And the evening would say, this is what I did today. And so we'd started out every day going, this is day number 16. The next day, this is day number 17. So that's how you keep track. And there was some time right around the 60s where I got a little confused, like, is this 61 or 62? I can't remember. The only other thing you have to go off of is there's the date on the camera. So I would know when Halloween was. I did not know when Thanksgiving was. I knew it was coming up, but I have no idea if it's Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. So, and I didn't remember what the date was going to be. I didn't even think about that before I left. I knew it was around Thanksgiving, but I didn't know what day it was. And I can say now that day 75 was December 1st.
Oh, congratulations. That is getting late in the season, and there was some reference to hours of daylight, so it seemed like it was early December.
Yeah, the days were definitely short. They said 7 hours of daylight, but if you're inside a shelter, I can tell you that you don't know it's daylight till after an hour when the sun's already up. It was more like 5 hours, and then by 4, 4:30, you were done for the day.
I know we only see on the show just a tiny fraction of each contestant's time out there. If you put together the, I think it's 11 episodes, 11 hours worth of thing, that's nothing like the 10 contestants' time and times an average of 50 or 60 days. So
Right.
there's probably a lot of things that we just don't see. But that said, you seem to do as much or more scavenging as opposed to hunting than many of the contestants. You had the fruit leather and mentioned it on a number of occasions. And that seems like a beneficial thing, but tell us about both the fruit leather, I think that's really interesting, and any other scavenging that you did.
Yeah, I guess I would call it foraging as opposed to
Foraging, sure.
scavenging.
That's probably a better word. Thank you.
Yeah, I like that better. I had a lot of berries in my sight because I was in a wildfire burn, and the hillsides there were just prolific with berries. I actually felt guilty, and I would force myself to stop picking because, like, I should be doing something else and getting more protein. But on the other hand, it's like I just had to keep picking. And in the end, it paid off because I was able to still have berries all the way till the last day. In fact, I came home with most of my fruit leather still. So yeah, there's definitely a balance between foraging, like you see Temujin getting all that Icelandic moss. I did not have that much moss, edible moss in my area, but I definitely had the berries. And then it's just whatever food is available, whether it's the fish, squirrels, muskrat, beaver, bear. When you need food, you just get whatever you can have, mushrooms. And, ideally, we want to have a balanced meal, right, of carbohydrates and protein and everything you need for minerals, but you get what you get.
Certainly, it's one of the things that would most likely intimidate most viewers, putting themselves into that position, having to find their own food to hunt and to forage. And so it's something that separates people. And the skills are evident, and all of the contestants seem to have really good skills. It comes down, I think, maybe to some luck and some gear choices and some strategy. We've talked a little bit about a couple of those things. Let's talk about some of the gear choices. You had 10 items you could take. In retrospect, what's the would you have changed any of the 10 items?
I was really happy with the 10 items I took. I've been asked, like, what's the most important item you took? And the first thing I think of is my sleeping bag, negative 60 degree bag. With that, I really didn't need a fire to stay warm. There was a number of nights, especially in the beginning, but even towards the end where I was just tired and the more firewood, like Juan Pablo, it just takes energy to build a fire. And I was boiling my water, so I was making sure, I have to have a fire to boil my water. But there were evenings where I just didn't even build a fire. I was like, I'm just going to get my sleeping bag. I'm nice and warm in there and conserve my energy. So that was, I think a sleeping bag is something That would have been a hard one to let go. I might have taken, we had a lot of fishing line, paracord, and trapping wire. Maybe next time, I wish I could have done like half the trapping wire and half the fishing line and done a combination, but you don't get that option. But you could do away with one of those depending on your situation.
You chose not to take a saw, and I think that you might have been the only contestant who did, or one of only a small number. It didn't seem to impede you in any way.
No, it really comes down to a choice of, and that was a last minute decision. Do I take a saw or do I take an axe? And it really comes down to, do you want to cut your wood with the grain or against the grain? And I chose the axe, and I don't regret that decision. In my case, I never ended up cutting firewood. There's a couple of pieces I cut in half, but I cut them pretty long and fed them into my fire in kind of in a teepee way, where you just kind of continuously feed them in. But I did not have to chop any firewood. I broke off all those sticks and just fed them into the fire as is. The other half of that question, a saw or an axe, a lot of people took both, but they also did not take a food ration. And I was not willing to give up my food ration. To me, that was something that was really going to help me out. And it did, because I ate my last bite of food ration the day before I tapped.
We didn't see that, or at least I don't recall seeing that. So tell us more about what the food ration consists of. And was it something you could choose, or is it something that the producers say this is the standard issue food ration?
Yeah, they gave a couple of options. You could use the gorp, you know, the peanuts, raisins. Some people choose that because then you can use the peanuts for bait for squirrels. I chose the pemmican, which is berries, fat, and dried meat, because that's what the indigenous cultures would use. And that has all the minerals that you need out there, especially the fat is a great thing to have out there. And I just love pemmican. They don't show you eating your food ration out there, and they have some reason behind it, but it's like everybody knows you have it, but they don't like to film you eating it for some reason. This is so
Yeah.
that's why you never see it on the show. It's just kind of one of these things we don't really talk about, but it's there.
Do most of the contestants choose the food ration?
Think only three of us did this season. And other seasons, like season two and three, everybody took one, and some people even took two food rations. But back then, they were allowed 5 pounds. We only
Hmm.
had, our food rations were only 2 pounds. So it gets harder and harder as time goes on.
Sure, that makes sense. Look. Other gear equipment thing I'm curious about, the number of contestants either reflected on losing arrows or the significance or the number they were down to. How many arrows are you given? How many did you lose? And tell us the impact, the emotional impact of losing it. We saw some of it, but I'd like you to dig a little deeper than what we saw on camera.
Yeah, so you're allowed to take 9 arrows, and then you can choose what kind of tips you want. I did take 3 rubber blunt tips, and I will never do that again. I did not like them at all. But losing an arrow is, yeah, losing one's okay, maybe two, but some people, I think Adam said he got down to one or two arrows, and he's like, that's not good. He ended up finding a number of his. All in all, I did lose a couple, but in the very end, I found all of them except one. So one of them's still out there somewhere. And in this last episode, I was in the trees and I shot out so that the arrow would land somewhere in the snowfield, and it just disappeared. And I looked around and around, and I was like, oh, dang, I lost an arrow. But then they show me just sitting down in the snow, staring off into space for a minute. But the funny thing was, as I sat down, like, dang, I lost an arrow. And I looked down, and right at the bottom of the hill, it was sticking up out of the snow. And it was way off of my trajectory. So how it got there, I have no idea. But I was like, oh man, I lost this arrow. I was going to sit down. I sat down, like, oh, there it is. I just had to just stop for a second.
got to be a relief. One thing I want to make sure to ask you, and up until the last couple of episodes, it wasn't really clear with the first people that left that there was any deconstruction of the site. But then in the last few people leaving, you could see probably the producers with time-lapse photography taking the shelters apart and restoring the site. And of course, that's the big appearing stuff, but you've mentioned the potential lost arrows, and I'm thinking there may be things like some snares that would have been left. Or how thorough do they do the decommissioning of the site?
Yeah, they do a really good job. They might film all of them, but they only show the last couple of people out there. And I think it's really brilliant on how they do that. They try to put everything back into its natural state. They also will take down your traps. And typically, once you're given time to recuperate, they will take you back out to your site so that you can go get your traps. In my case, and Juan Pablo and probably Timogen, once we came in, the temperatures dropped down to negative 30 degrees, and we all had to leave the place. What they did for me is that I drew a map of where my traps were, and I had to do that for myself because I was losing track of them. And so I drew them with charcoal and I gave them the map, and then they went out and found every single trap except for maybe one, which was amazing because it's underneath at least 2 feet of snow. So
Yeah.
yeah, they did a really
So,
good job and they do their best to just try to put everything back. So
and some of those little snares have to be pretty small to capture squirrels.
yeah, they're not the easy ones. And most of mine were on the ground. I didn't have them up on logs. A few times, but most of mine were on the ground, so they immediately got buried. Not ideal.
One of the moments on camera, and I don't remember which episode it was in, somewhere in the middle of the pack, if you will. You took a muskrat, and it was the actual taking was off camera. You were not in sight. You could hear you, and we could see water and fields and a lot of excitement. And I just sense there's a whole lot more to that story than we saw.
Yes,
Would
it
you
definitely is.
share that?
That's day 37, which is one of my favorite numbers. It's a prime number. The day 37. Yeah, so it came up on shore. So we're not allowed to trap them. So we have to shoot them with bow and arrow. It came up on shore, like they often do. And I shot at it, but it was underneath a willow branch or underneath a willow bush. And I had just washed my hair. So my hair is loose, but the arrow did not penetrate through the muskrat. They have huge spines, and I shot it just below the spine, but it didn't go through. It wasn't a clean kill. And so I basically had to dive underneath that willow bush, and my hair was so tangled up in those branches that I don't even know what happened to the arrow. But what happened is that the fishing line, he had flipped over so many times, the fishing line wrapped around his body. So then I clenched down on the fishing line and had it kind of tucked down, pinched down between some branches. And he would calm down for a second. Then he'd start moving. And I was like, I didn't want him to go back in the water. And then I had these envisions of Nikki on season six who got bit by a squirrel. So I was like, no, don't bite me. Like, I don't want to relive this one. And then I had it pinned down again, so it flipped a few times. It was a 5 minute battle. It was not the 30, 10, 15 seconds they showed. I had it pinned down, and then I was like, okay, I need my knife, but my knife is in a Velcro cargo pocket on my pants, and it's inside my Leatherman sheath, which is also Velcro. I tried to get it out, and then he squirmed again, so I went back and wrestled him. And then eventually I got my knife out, and then I was able to dispatch him. And so it was a very exciting battle, and that's why I came out. My hair's all messed up. It's like, whoa, I don't know what just happened, but because I couldn't see half of what was going on. It was just like enough to see, like, keep from getting bitten and get your knife out and get her done. But that muskrat was so good. I was obsessed with muskrats after that.
It seemed like it because at one point you had makeup, homemade makeup, charcoal on, and bones dressed up as a muskrat, Susie and Slim, I think it was.
Yeah, Muskrat Susie, Muskrat Sam.
Sam, yep. In fact, I think that was even picked up by an outdoor magazine for an article on some of the most entertaining, amusing incidents in the last 9 seasons.
Yeah, it was fun. And I don't know if you know that song or remember from 1972, Captain and Tennille sang the
I
Muskrat
do.
song.
Not all of our listeners will, but those of a certain age, of course, will.
So I posted something like, in case you don't remember, this is the song. But I had that song in my head for like weeks after that. But my whole Halloween skit was based off the love story in that song. I was kind of trying to relive it.
Are the contestants encouraged to do a Halloween skit, or is that something just several of you came up with?
No, just up to us. Whatever we need to do to entertain ourselves and to entertain you, that's what we do.
Very good. You've mentioned a couple times the aftercare, the recuperation, and we don't see that on camera. And I think that's a very interesting phase, probably, and it has to be meaningful for contestants and yourself. Tell us a little more about what you go through with that.
Yeah, this is a great question in an area that's kept behind the scenes. Once you get back to base camp, filming is done. They did show Adam coming off the helicopter and giving Tom a big old hug, which was so beautiful to see that. They also do the fireside chats that's filmed back at base camp once you've had a couple of days to recuperate. But yeah, when you come back, they have an aftercare system set up and a refeeding program. So everybody's in a different state when they come back. Some people just need a little nourishment. But they just want to make sure that your vital signs are good, that you're eating right, that your body is functional, that they don't want to just send you in a plane and have you pass out on the phone. If you need to go to the hospital, they helivac you to the hospital, which happened with Jesse for sure. But when you're in that refeeding program, they monitor how many calories you're taking in, because if you eat too many calories at one time, that will put your system in shock. And in fact, when I was on the hunt for the snowshoe hare, and because I was so far along, if I had eaten that whole snowshoe hare, that could have been detrimental. So if I had gotten a hare, I would have to eat it really. Space it out. Stay back. I was only allowed to eat 600 calories and then the 800 calories. So they slowly rebuild you up to your 2000 calories and then food as tolerated. And they just want to make sure that you're going to go home healthy and be able to handle life. Like, yeah, they take good care of you when you get out.
I think that's comforting and encouraging to hear too. I had one other burning question. Maybe that's not the right, burning's not the right word, about the experience. We watched in the last few episodes the river ice over, and several of the remaining contestants struggle with finding water. And you either had no struggle or we didn't see it. What was your water source?
I tell you what, I lucked out. There was a freshwater spring right by my shelter, and that river froze over overnight. Like I woke up, it's like, whoa, the whole river was frozen over. It did thaw out, and it was fun to watch the breakup, and then it refroze again. But that was shocking to see, to step out of your shelter. You're used to seeing a river, and all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, there's a big blanket of ice there. My stream was moving fast enough that there was only a few days it would ice over a little bit. And when that deep, deep freeze came, it iced over a couple inches. I'm like, oh no, I didn't think about this. What if this dries up? I'm a long ways from the river. But I covered it with branches. And after that couple of days, it never thawed out. Excuse me, it never froze over again. So I really lucked out on my water source. I may not have even had to boil it, but I did because of all the bogs that are above me. And even if the water's coming from underground, it's still coming from that stagnant water above. So I didn't want to take the risk of not boiling my water. It wasn't worth getting Giardia or losing out on $500,000 just because I was too lazy to boil my water.
And again, this is where, to a certain degree, I think a luck factor sits in. The final contestant, on a number of occasions, we saw him drinking straight from the river. And so he obviously survived.
Yeah, and
And
his take on it was like, hey, I'm Mexican. I've drank some of the worst water, and he had all the, stuff in his belly to take it. So that was good on him.
A good gut and or a lucky experience. But polar bears, a lot of promotion about being polar bear country. We didn't see anyone that encountered a polar bear, but again, I know we didn't see everything that was probably experienced by all of the contestants. Did you
Yeah.
find one? Do you, to your knowledge, did any of the other contestants come across one?
No.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah. The polar bears are mostly going to be on the coast, and we were a few miles inland, except for Benji, Igor, and Terry. They were down by the coast, so they probably had to keep an eye out more. But they are predators and they will hunt you. So it doesn't matter. You're still going to keep an eye out for them. And we were instructed if you actually see a polar bear, we needed to call it in. And that's part of regulations because the agencies want to be able to track the polar bears where they're at. And luckily, no one saw one. I know Juan Pablo was excited because he really wanted to see one. But I don't think anybody really did. This is a good thing.
Probably for the best. So, a few more questions here, and I want to talk about the impact after the show. But what was the best part of the experience and the worst part?
The best part, that's the harder question. The
Yes, sure.
best
It
part,
usually is.
I mean, a highlight definitely was getting that muskrat, but I know I wanted to have that experience of being in my shelter, cozy, warm, with there might be a blizzard going on outside, but I don't care because I'm cozy, warm, and having a plate of food would be a bonus. And that's exactly what happened in episode 10. They kind of mixed it up time-wise. The story wasn't in the right order. But I got that squirrel first as I was collecting pitch to start my cob oven fire because I knew a storm was coming in. Then I built up the wall that next night. I didn't even eat my squirrel. The next day, the snowstorm came in, and now I'm in my shelter having this experience that I wanted. Cozy, warm, blizzard outside, and I've got squirrel meat. And so, to be honest, I was almost going to tap out after that because I was like, hey, that was great. I had my personal experience. I'm good to go. But then this whole turnaround thing happened with my friend Colette, who I dedicated my journey to. And it was because of her. I'm like, wow, I haven't given it my all. I can stay out here. And so I did for obviously 2 more weeks. So, that was a definite highlight. The hardest part, and I'll just be honest, was going poop. It was painful. It took a lot of time. It was not pleasant whatsoever. And I don't know if I want to share the gory details on that on public radio, but
I think
that is the tough.
probably good enough, although I do have to ask. I'm sure you weren't digging a fresh cat hole every day for 75 days or however many. Did you build a latrine of sorts? Did the contestants do that?
You can for sure. When you're not eating so much food,
You're not going as often.
you're not going as often, and your digestive system all slows down, all that metabolism to almost to where it's stopping, and then things back up because things are not moving. And that's why it gets so painful and so hard, is because now you have to force your system to do something that it's taking a nap. It's asleep. It doesn't want to do anything, but you have to because the toxins are going to back up into your stomach and that can kill you. So that's why I'm saying it was so painful. to make that all happen.
Well,
I think for me, I just made it happen once a week. And every time I found out there's a med check, like, because that's one of the questions they ask you. Oh, when was your last poop? So I would always try to do it the day before so I could give them my A plus card, like, oh, I went poop. I'm good. Yeah.
I know even after our long hikes, there's only a small handful of full things that you come back and go, I have a whole new appreciation for fill in the blank. And one of those things are just simply toilet seats. I have a whole new appreciation for them.
Yeah. Well, I know the first time the first couple of weeks, it was 13 days and I could feel it backing up in my stomach. And I was like, I actually did not feel well. I knew I had to do something about it and I knew I'd let it go too long. And then after that, I said, I'm not going to do that. You know, once a week, that's the longest I'm going to let it go.
So I see they've been advertising a couple of new takes on the Alone series with previous contestants. And if they called you up, would you do it again or some variation of it again?
I would do it again in a heartbeat. Right now, it's too early. I'm still recuperating. I've lost some of my stamina. My digestive system is, I'm still working on that, but it's coming along. I feel good about that. But they say it takes a while to recuperate, like a year or two. It takes a while. But if the opportunity comes up, I'll definitely go back out. For sure.
Excellent. I think I tried to ask you this question in the preseason interview, and we got suggested by the producers to wait until the end. So, what advice would you give would-be contestants?
If they were going out?
If they want to be on the show, maybe two categories here: A, how to get selected, and B, okay, you've been selected. Now, what do you do to prepare? If you could give a couple tips of sage advice for either of those.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of highly skilled people out there. It takes more than skills. It takes your ability to be able to be comfortable with yourself because you are alone. And some people leave because of their families, which is beautiful as well. And they had, I think, something like 25,000 people apply for our season. And if you're just so and so, and you go online and apply, it's not very likely that they're even going to see their email just because there's so many. It's not that they don't want to, it's just overwhelmingly, it's impossible. So it's really good to get yourself out there, especially on like social media, show your skills, show you've got what it takes, meet people. A reference from someone who's already been on the show or somebody who's already been applied for the show is a good way to go because then they know, hey, this person's real and they're not full of crap because there's a lot of people who think they know what they're doing and they don't. Where what I call couch survivalists, we all are. I know I've watched the show, I was like, I would have done that different. You just don't have the information to know what was really the right call to do. So yeah, I would recommend just getting your name out there and getting a referral is a great way to go. Once you're selected and they're looking at you, don't fake who you are, be authentic because you are who you are. All these filters are going to drop away. I tried to not show any of my spirituality parts in the beginning, and then after a while, like, you know, I'm doing pretty good with this and I want people to know what's really holding me out there. So I kind of let my guard down, let filters drop, and allowed myself to be vulnerable. But if you're applying for the show, you just have to be authentic with yourself. And they can read through, they'll know if you're bluffing and just kind of like pretending you know it. They know, they can see through it. You're being tested by survival experts out there and giving their input. And they can see right away that, oh, they don't really know how to handle a knife and they don't really know what they're doing. And yeah, you won't make it that way. Can't fake it.
Can't fake it. That's good advice for a lot of things.
Yeah, right.
You're back, and you've been back a while, and now the show's over. And you've mentioned several times during the show and social media here locally about the school, about your school and how you're taking it to the next level. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, starting a new school has been a dream of mine for many, many years. I just haven't had the place to do it. And a year ago last spring, I purchased a piece of property. And at this point, I'm already transitioning. I have taken down my yurt that I've been living in for 20 something years, taken that all down, my whole solar system, the rain system, everything. And it's now all in storage. And now I am, this fall, will be putting everything back up and rebuilding on the new land. And funny you asked me that because I am launching a GoFundMe fundraiser for the infrastructure of the school because it's raw land and I need to have a well. I need to be able to put in, storage and make it in order for the school to be successful, I need to have some infrastructure, some tenting platforms. And I've created a list of exactly where the money would be going to. And the other reality piece of it is I'm 58 years old and I now have a 30-year mortgage. And I do not have 30 more working years left in my body, this life. And so I'm raising funds to help with the infrastructure and to pay off at least part of the land so that it makes it more doable for me. And at the very bottom of the list, if there's an abundance of financial assistance, then I'll be able to rebuild a house for me to live in because right now I don't have anything to live in. And I'm not, we'll see what I end up doing for winter, but that's where I'm at right now is to raise some funds for the school.
Well, all you need is one of those large but very thin pieces of tarp and an axe and some abundant locally small lodgepole pines, it looks like. But
Yeah, I might just build a shelter and hunker down for the winter, but I'll have food this time.
you've touched a little bit on the spirituality, and anyone who's watched the season, I think, has that come through or who knows you. But if you want to dig a little into that.
Yeah, I was really amazed at about how much of that they showed. They haven't done that in past seasons. I think season 8, there was the first time they showed someone singing, or maybe that was season 7. And then we got Biko singing because he's a rock star singer. So I wasn't really expecting that, but I was filming myself doing it anyway. But the songs are really what held me and kept me going. Like when I was really tired, I would sing the Cree Wanishka song, and it was really upbeat and light and would get me going, and I kind of pumped in through all day. But this, yeah, the songs really helped me keep my attitude up and carry me through. And I think that was really important for people to see. And the other difference about our whole season, not just me, but every contestant had some kind of a spiritual side to them. And I noticed that going in, that something's different about this season. And our group picture, instead of the picture where everybody's looking rough and tough and like, yeah, I'm, bad, you know what? Our picture, we're all smiling. And I was like, they're gonna do something different with our episode. And they did, and they really showed something spiritual about every person as they tapped out. And I think that's beautiful because that's the way life is. It's not about being rough and tough, and that's not what survival and skills are about. That's just a small portion of it. So I was really excited to see. I was really honored to be a part of that season. Yeah.
Well, that is a very nice note to end on. And so I would like to, as we close out this interview, thank our guest, Carrie Lee Kanoki, the founder of Sacred Cedars Wilderness School, primitive skills instructor, energy medicine practitioner, brain tanner, herbalist, naturalist, minimalist, total off-gridder. And now to her resume, you can add a participant in the final episode, one of the final two on Alone Season 9. 75 days alone in the Labrador wilderness. Just fantastic. Congratulations and thank you for coming on the show, Carrie.
Thank you. And I'd just like to add, if anybody feels like they want to support the school, you can go to my website at carrieleekanoki.com. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show, Phil. It's been great.
Thank you, Carrie.